In Vancouver, there's been some good work done in researching where a lot of the diesel emissions are coming from. In fact, there was a good series in the Vancouver Sun, it was last summer, I think. Yeah, it was last summer. A series of very good articles, very well researched on the tonnage of diesel emissions, a lot of it from the Vancouver Harbor, from the ships, the shipping traffic. And then that's a jurisdictional issue, you know, federally regulated, so how can the province or the city deal with that is something we still have to look at. But I mean, when you look at the GVRD taking a decision, or TransLink taking a decision to go to a lower quality fuel that's going to load the environment with more diesel emissions, more sulfur compounds like sulfur dioxides, which may have been the cause of the respiratory problems your members were experiencing, but more than that, well-known carcinogens. I mean, we have really good and effective anti-smoking regulations and legislation in this province in terms of smoking in public places, relatively good labeling laws saying, you know, what's in cigarette smoke. But big campaigns and government-sponsored campaigns about that. At the same time, we're putting exactly the same carcinogens into the environment in diesel emissions that you find in cigarette smoke. Things like benzoapyrene is one example. And then there are the aldehydes like formaldehyde, which is another carcinogen well-known and used widely in industry. But these are all emissions and or components of those emissions. And so if you have this public concern, and then finally, I think the tipping point in terms of your situation was you and your coworkers taking that on and saying, look, you know, we have a right to a safer workplace. And whether they knew it or you knew it at the time, there is in fact regulation in this province that should have prohibited from the outset the choice of that fuel when there is a safer fuel, diesel 1 versus diesel 2. So they really were violating the law right from the beginning. And I think that when you brought that to their attention, because I think we discussed it in a toxins course where you participated, that certainly would have had an impact. So the more we get that kind of activism at the workplace linked to public health issues, because they all are public health issues in the end. I mean, if your members are getting sick and they're going to the hospital, that affects our public health system. It's not simply a workplace problem. And we need to break down those artificial barriers that others often place between, you know, worker health and safety and public health and safety, the public health system and our concerns about that, and workers' compensation systems. Because there's a lot of offloading from the workers' comp system where people aren't adequately compensated or their injuries or illnesses aren't recognized to the public health system. And I mean, so there's a number of areas where I think we need to work out ways of working together between environmental issues and worker health and safety issues and the whole public agenda around environment.
Well, the one thing I would like to say is that, for one thing, we found very good was the fact that we did work well within our own groups through the drivers local 111 with OPIU, QP. There was people in all levels, all walks, even management, that thought the whole original decision wasn't the one to be made. And, you know, the public obviously got on board as well towards the end. And that's, you know, on behalf of our members, I'd like to say thank you to everybody for helping as well. And for you people from Lees, we learned a lot from the toxin course. And I think in the long run, the right decision was made. And I think there's still more ways they can go ahead. I think, you know, obviously we're looking at all the new buses, the newer the equipment, the better they are. We have hydrogen traps, catalysts on the buses, obviously the newer ones, it's reducing the emissions. One thing that I think they could possibly look at, which I haven't heard of, is probably even going to a low, very low sulfur fuel. I think as a buying group, for example, if something like the GVRD with all the different members from all the municipalities plus transit, plus anybody else that they could get in, if they were looking at a buying group, they could look at purchasing an ultra-low fuel. The cost may be a little more per liter, but, you know, again, you have to weigh the environmental issues with it as well. So.
And the offloaded health costs. I mean, that's the point that Larry's making, is that lots of times people get very sick from being exposed to these things, and it costs their families and it costs the medical system a lot of money, and it's an offloading because we're too cheap to buy fuel that's proper in the first place. So a number of the people from your local took the course Toxins in the Workplace, which is co-facilitated by the BC Federation of Labour Occupational Health and Safety Program and the Labour Environmental Alliance. And you folks did some really inspiring things when you went back to work. Maybe you could describe some of those things just in terms of the other toxins that are in
Well, one of the things with the diesel fuel, we found that it's, we started looking at exposures to what we were exposed to in general, rather than, you know, the diesel fuel was sort of the catalyst that set it all off. But we started looking, we started realizing the number of things that we were exposed to on a regular basis. All the different cleaning materials, all the different solvents, the sprays that we use, the paint. I mean, obviously, there's been big changes in the paint industry and through the GVRD and their air stuff on that. But we started looking at all our things, and we kind of had the, after looking at it, we figure there's somewhere between 14 and probably 20% of the products we use have some sort of either a carcinogen, a reproductive a blocker, or a sensitizer in it. So we basically started looking, and we January of last year, we asked the company to look at it, and we'd like to review what we're using, and is there a possibility of replacing it with something that is less toxic? To do that, what we've found is that if we what we have to do first is get everything categorized on a computer system, and then we know what we've got. And obviously, we're a big company, and there's a lot of different shops. So some people were buying outside stuff that they were using, and then most of it was bought centrally. Anything centrally was already on the sheets, and obviously we had MSDS and WMIS information on them. But what we want to do is then, by going back to the computer, we can ask it for any particular product. Mm-hmm. Is there, like, for example, benzene in it? Is there any arsenic in it? And then we could cross-reference and say, well, okay, these products have it. Isn't there a possibility that we could cost, not being cost prohibitive, but if available, can we replace it? Mm-hmm. So we've started that. It's a slow process, just like the diesel fuel. It took us a while. We've made the first steps. It's sort of the to get the funding, to get the resources is more, as a union, we don't have it. It's more up to the company to, and we feel this is something that definitely the union and the company can work together on, and this is something that's an advantage. If we're healthier, it's great for us. If we're less time away from work, it's a cost saving for the company, and then for society and the community as a whole, it's a better if we're not using as many toxins. Obviously, the public rides it, children ride our buses, cleaning solutions, everything. One of the other things that we kind of also realized that was kind of an interesting thing is, for example, you're under a bus and there's something stuck, a bolt. You know, you get, for example, the first gentleman will spray WD-40 on it. Well, it still doesn't loosen. The next gentleman or the same guy will put on something like Move It, and then he'll put on, that doesn't do it. So then he puts on something like Rusty 2000 or something. Well, that doesn't do it. So finally, what's he do? He heats it. So we always wonder, you know, in exposures, are we looking at, we're also mixing chemicals that may have an effect on the on our members that we're not even realizing ourselves, you know. So hopefully at this point, we're hoping to go forward more with this review and to be able to say that, you know, some of the chemicals will be very difficult to replace. Certain things are for cleaners, for antifreeze and stuff. It's very hard to replace. There is nothing else probably out there that will do as the same job. But if we can get the numbers down is what we're looking for. And we're looking at a long-term effect for our members. Something, you know, we're exposed to this, not just today, but every day for you know, 20, 30, 35, 40 years, some of the members.
Yeah, I mean, there are more and more substitutes out there. I mean, a few years ago, it was harder than it is now. I mean, there are a number of companies that produce chemical products that have a whole line that they bring out that have fewer of some of these more toxic ingredients in them. And they have them because they've been asked for them. And one of the problems that you raise is, you know, unions or workplace health and safety committees don't have the time and the resources given to them to deal with that. And it really is the employer's responsibility, legally, to actually look for and find less toxic materials to use. And the problem we find in general is that unless you have a very forward-looking, progressive employer, and when you do, it's very effective. If you don't, you need regulations, you need them enforced, or legislation enforced. Not only in terms of workers' comp regulations, but, you know, municipal or regional bylaws. I mean, it strikes me, you know, we're doing, one of the things we're involved in is developing a best practices review internationally of all of the different activities that are going on, not only voluntarily with NGOs, but also with governments and regulations to try and eliminate carcinogens and reproductive toxins from our environment. It's called the precautionary principle, you know, in the jargon of the day, and that is that you try and eliminate a hazard where you know it's potentially hazardous, rather than wait until there are enough people sick and enough stats to prove that this thing should be banned or something. I mean, you basically act before you damage the environment and people's health. And there are some municipalities, for example, that have that as a purchasing policy for all of their materials. San Francisco passed a bylaw to that effect last year, as one example. We started a little bit in Canada with some sewage bylaws in Toronto, and Vancouver's now going to ban the use of cosmetic pesticides in a few years. There's no reason why that couldn't be a policy throughout the GVRD, and would have stopped the move from diesel 1 to diesel 2, for example, before it even happened. Not to mention all the other products that you're struggling with trying to find substitutes. The other thing that strikes me is that, I mean, we spent 5 years developing, more like 10 years, developing a regulation under the Workers' Compensation Board regulation that would require substitution for less toxic materials for more, and not to use carcinogens in the workplace, as an example. You've just said you identified 15 to 20% of your products that may contain that. Where's the board's enforcement on that? You know, or if we're talking about resources, I mean, they're funded. They have prevention funding as well. Why don't they have a person that's looking into finding substitutes for workplaces like yours, where people, workers and employers, could phone them and say, okay, this is a list of the products we're using that have these very toxic materials in them. We'd like to find substitutes. Could you help us do that research? I mean, instead, they're just cutting.
So what ends up happening is it ends up being, you know, union health and safety activists like CAW Local 2200 that make the marks. And I guess one of the things that needs to happen is that the public needs to be more aware of some of the rules and responsibilities around not exposing workers to carcinogens on their work site, and to supporting more enforcement. I mean, we're a society that is so not wanting enforcement now. I mean, that's the government of the day doesn't want to see that kind of enforcement. And so it gets really hard, and it's the only people that are doing it is union health and safety activists. Would you say that's true?
I think we're probably in the leading forefront of it. You know, I mean, by bringing the things forward, we hope that, you know, the companies will take a serious look at it and put the resources forward that we need. You know, being a health and safety officer, and you can't do it all on your own. You need, you know, I think as a group, it's a win-win situation for both us, the company, and the society, and then the community as a whole. I don't see, figure in the long run, the light will come on and everybody will work together and we'll move on from there.
And there's no, I mean, it's in everyone's best interest that we do that. And one of the things that we know time and time again is that if we eliminate a product that contains a carcinogen, inevitably another product shows up that does the same job and that's just about as cost effective. And we have to start looking at that whole business of offloading all the time. So thank you for doing the work that you do on our buses and in our cities, and for getting rid of that dirty old number 2 fuel.